I'm Shachar Azani, and in the news, Israel at war. It's been 5 months, yes, 5 long months, since the atrocious, savage massacre against innocent Israelis on October 7th, 2023. As Israel continues its attack on Hamas in Gaza, the attacks against Israel and against Jewish communities worldwide intensify. Where do we stand, and where do we go from here? To answer these questions and so much more, joining us now is someone who has just returned from an extensive and profound visit to Israel, which included meetings with senior officials, think tanks, and ordinary Israelis on the ground. It is no one else but our dear friend, Dr. Eric Mendel. Dr. Mendel is the founder and director of MEPIN, Middle East Political and Information Network. He's a senior security editor at the Jerusalem Report and a prolific writer and speaker. Eric, thank you so much for joining us.
Always. Thank you for having me.
Let me first ask you, immediately, let's go to your trip. What was your impression on the ground, visiting Israel, speaking with Israelis, meeting Israelis from all walks of life? How was that experience? Please share with us.
So I think we in America can at best sympathize with Israelis, American Jews here, or Israel supporters. We can't empathize. So many Americans have never been in war, sent their children in harm's way, that literally, when I saw I was embedded with troops in the north and the south, and I was in Judea and Samaria, they're fighting literally from their homes. I was a short time ago in Margaliot, which is up in the top of the Hula Valley. And I said to a soldier in a bunker looking into Lebanon, "Where's your house?" And we looked through the bunker to the left, and there was his house. And it wasn't the first time. So we really have a very hard time. So I think we should, the first thing is we Americans, we should be humbled before we give advice to people who are fighting literally from three sides at this point of time. I drove from the northern border to the southern border in just a little over 3 hours. The society, getting back to your question,
Yeah. The
society is traumatized, but amazingly resilient. And I have to say, and this is going to be something that will, I think, shock your viewers, is I'm optimistic about Israel for the future. I really do believe the society will come together despite all the problems that happened before October 7th and after October 7th. They live meaningful lives and they know what they're living for, secular and religious, right to left. I'm actually optimistic, and we have to look past the immediate, but the immediate is overwhelming.
You know, you're talking about knowing, what you're living for, and Israel has gone from almost, near a social implosion right before that ferocious attack into what we see now. In your meetings in Israel, and I know, you've met with senior Israeli leadership, I'm curious to ask you about meetings you had or conversations you had. You mentioned that soldier with ordinary Israelis. What was their feeling about, I think we see it as overwhelming from all the way from here. You can only imagine what it's like there. How were they treating all of this?
So it depends upon where you are. If you're in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, it looks normal, but they're not normal. They are. It's an amazing phenomenon. You could be in synagogue in the morning on a Shabbat morning, and they're saying the prayers for soldiers who have, who they've lost, or for the injured. And 5 minutes later, there's a joy. They're celebrating a baby naming or upcoming nuptials. It's amazing how they still enjoy and embrace life. But the people in the north, there is somewhere between 60 and 100,000 who are afraid to go home. They were evacuated. It's questions whether they ever should have been evacuated in the first place, believe it or not. But they are going to not be able to go home and feel totally confident. The people around the Gaza envelope, I think they're going to be more confident because I think Israel's presence and probably the buffer zone, which our administration is against, will give them some ability to be secure. But the truth of the matter is, if Israel is forced by the Biden administration not to end Hamas's infrastructure and the terrorists that are there, which is what I saw a report in the Times of Israel this morning saying that they may slow walk the supply of munitions. If Israel is forced to allow Hamas to stay and not look as a victor at the end, it will be devastating for the Israeli people and really hurt American interests, Israeli interests, and Israeli interests in creating a rapprochement with the Arab countries who want to develop relations with them.
Eric, I'm quite shocked with what you just said. The mere idea of Hamas still standing on its weak and fragile feet at the end of this war is something that is completely unfathomable to Israelis. And I'm not just talking about leadership. I know there is a tendency to focus on the political leadership and blame Israel's political leadership for whatever. But the truth is, and correct me if my perception is different, if your perception is different, Israelis at the end of this war want to make sure that Hamas is over and done with politically and militarily. There is no way that Hamas can be allowed to stay on its feet. Did you get a different impression being in Israel?
Oh, that's exactly correct. I mean, I think for Americans, the analogy is, let's imagine that we said with Daesh, ISIS, Islamic State, right, that we were going to finish them off 80% and leave them in some territorial place to continue to launch attacks.
Right.
It's incomprehensible to Israelis. Israelis, once this war occurred, this became 1948. They are in an existential fight for their lives.
Correct.
And that not only for the 7 million Jewish civilians that are there, it's important for our interests. And Israel has to come out of this as a victor. It is perverse to Israelis that the Palestinians should be rewarded with a automatic resumption of the peace process. It's incomprehensible to Israelis, even those who are for two states for two peoples. And by the way, we can commend President Biden for using the words two states or two peoples. Most people use the shorthand two states, but to the Arab world, two states are two Arab states.
Right, that's very true. So I got to ask you, Eric, you're somebody with great experience on the Hill. You've met with elected officials across the board. You've briefed so many of them over the years, as we know so well. What aren't those officials in the Biden administration getting when it comes to this clear message from Israelis? It's not about Netanyahu. It's about Israelis in general. This is where Israel stands today. What is so difficult to understand?
You know, people conflate Israel with the government that's there now. That would be like saying you don't like a Trump administration, America doesn't have a right to exist. That's crazy. This is a democratic government, and they have created a coalition, and it's not a great coalition, and lots of people can shoot at it, but it is what is there at this time, and it is not purely Israel. But as I tell people all the time, whether Yair Lapid or Benny Gantz, opposition leaders,
very
were
true,
in charge, prosecuting this war the same way Bibi Netanyahu is.
Right.
Having said that, I have an article in the Jerusalem Post today saying that the Israelis are, the Netanyahu administration coalition is basically into its political election mode and is pandering to a domestic audience and is undermining the message it's giving to the United States and the supporters that are there. So there really is a problem here. And I think the Israelis really need to know that the war going on right now may almost be more important, the war keeping American support. And what are Americans thinking? Getting back to your original question, they've come up with, yeah, October 7th was really terrible, but Israel is now doing even worse. And they don't know about the proportionality in the war and Israel's morality and ethics, and that they forget about that Hamas uses its people as as human shields,
right,
of why. And they're believing numbers that are ridiculously conflated, which makes the percentage of combatants killed to civilians small. Although, of course, every life is precious. But Israel is comporting with international law, and I think a lot in the administration have lost sight of that.
Yeah, and how can it even be compared between the targeted torture, massacre, and mutilations of innocents, which was done premeditatedly, compared to what Israel is trying to achieve? I mean, it's ridiculous on its face.
We live here in the West with, you know, it's ancient history, October 7th to them. They don't know that Israel has a couple of 100,000 people who are not in the homes. They don't know the thousands of reservists that have been injured. These are soldiers, but these are sanitation workers, doctors, lawyers, accountants who have been injured and can't take care of their families anymore. The devastation that Israel as a society has taken, and the focus is totally on the suffering, and there are sufferings of the Palestinians, or the humanitarian aid that is supposedly not going into, but is a much more complex story than that.
Right, and not to mention the fact that there is usually one word missing from those descriptions in what we see in Western media outlets, which is the word Hamas, as if this misery came out of nowhere and Hamas had nothing to do with it after ruling the Gaza Strip for 17 years. Eric, I got to ask you about the times. We're talking now about Ramadan. How significant is that factor in what's happening now on the ground in the Middle East, but specifically in the Gaza Strip and in Judea and Samaria?
So it was my assessment, and unfortunately, I think it's coming true, is Hamas did not want there to be a pause in the fighting for a hostage release, that they're using Ramadan as another front to try to incite Palestinians in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Palestinian citizens of Israel, Israeli Arabs, to have an uprising. And so I went in to Jenin and Nablus area with the deputy battalion commander in charge there to see what's going on. And I think what your viewers need to know is that Hamas, really Iran, has been inciting the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, for years, with weapons, with cash. And the only reason it has not gone out of control is because Israel has gone in every day to extract terrorists and stop terrorism. They do it all the time, way before October 7th, but it has dramatically increased. I will tell you, just on the other side, the administration is totally focused on some rogue settlers doing some bad things. But I wanted to go in firsthand to interview, and I found out there are some people that should be held responsible that do things to Palestinians, but in proportion, it is a tiny amount in comparison to the threat that Israelis are facing from radicalism and terrorism in the West Bank.
So let's hope, Hamas's plan, just like it was foiled on October 7th in their desire to create a multi-regional all-out war, let's hope they fail this time as well. But still, the war comes to mind, Eric. And when we look at the Gaza Strip, we look at incredible success of the Israel Defense Forces. I think, unbelievable success in historic proportions when it comes to the kind of urban warfare and underground warfare that's taking place. I'll also mention that according to initial estimates, the expectation, let's say, of potential casualties, the number was much higher in the initial estimates of the IDF. But still, there is one big cloud looming over it all, Eric, and that's called Rafah, and dealing with the Egyptian border and the Philadelphia course. We've seen Israel continuously announcing that plans are ready for an immediate operation there. Why isn't Israel moving forward with an operation in Rafah to conclude its operation against Hamas? So much has already been taken out as far as their infrastructure, their military installations, their underground tunnels, their factories. But Rafah is still standing. And according to some estimates, most of the hostages who may be still alive are there.
So for you who don't know, Rafah is the major city, really the main conduit of bringing in weapons from Egypt and the Sinai into Gaza. The Philadelphia corridor is 8.9 miles, the border between Sinai and Gaza.
Right.
So I can tell you, as of not that many days ago, the Israelis still had not made a decision about how to evacuate possibly a million civilians that are there. I've been chastising them again and again and again for way more than a month that they should have had a plan to get these people out. I said the original plan when the people move from the north to the south of 635 little squares where they move people around will not fly with this administration. And I said, at the very least, you should have been moving people out in anticipation of Rafah, even if you didn't want to go in until after Ramadan. And they have made, I think this is a major mistake, and I've been critical of both in my writings in public and also privately to the Israeli government, that it undermines their interest. They tell me Rafah will always be there and we can go in. And I say, you are incorrect. You have a timeline. The administration cannot keep, American administration cannot keep supporting you. And as I said, they're already thinking of slow walking arms that are there. And at the very least, if they would have started moving out civilians, that would have created leverage to let Hamas know you were serious about going into Rafah. There are four battalions in Rafah. By the way, there's two other intact battalions in central Gaza and refugee
right.
camps.
Correct.
That is, so it only knocked out about 60 to 70%. So Rafah, why they haven't done it, even though they say they will, I think they've really handled that situation purely on timing poorly, and it's to their disadvantage. And every day that they don't do it, it's going to get harder and harder. They need to do what they need to do for their existential interests.
That's very true. But you're indicating internal issues like preparedness and movement of civilian population so that they can execute the attack properly. What role did the world international community and specifically the U.S. played in trying to stop an Israeli attack over Rafah?
Well, there's a lot of behind the scenes pressure about it. And the pressure, I believe the administration said that they wanted a pause. The semantics changed. It went from pause to a ceasefire that can lead to a permanent ceasefire. But remember, the Israeli people want to release whatever hostages they can and were willing to do that. Because when I would talk to these soldiers in the field, reservists and regular soldiers, they feel that the IDF has failed in its primary mission to protect its civilians, and they need to get the hostages or as many out as they can. So Israel was willing to pause for a hostage deal, but now that a hostage deal appears to be far away, Israel should have gone into Rafah. Ramadan should not have been the speed bump in the way here. They're using that, and I have to say, evil can be brilliant, and the Hamas leadership has handled this and manipulated the situation so well to survive. They were really on the ropes, and they've given them some way out at this point of time. And by the way, we don't know. The reports are that the Hamas leadership in Qatar is on the same page as Sinwar and Mohammed Deif, who are supposedly the most true believers who are still within Rafah or Khan Yunis. So we're not exactly sure who is really calling the shots. By the way, just as an aside, getting to Qatar, Qatar has been hosting Hamas, funding Hamas,
right,
training Hamas police, but yet they're a major American non-NATO ally. Doesn't make sense.
Do you see Israel moving forward with such an attack anytime soon, in your estimate?
Depends upon how you define soon. I think that my best guess at this point is they're going to wait till after Ramadan. I think it's a mistake. I think they need to do what they need to do. But I don't see how they can, because they literally, I can tell you from the highest sources without naming anybody, they have not decided on a plan for how to evacuate the civilians. And this is going to be very complex. So that means why I say not soon. I think they have to do that, or else they're going to totally rupture relations with the Biden administration, and they cannot do that. Israel is dependent upon its only friend in the world, the United States.
Right. You're talking about the Rafah border with Egypt, and of course the Philadelphia course. There are reports about the Egyptians prepping some territory there for possible acceptance of Palestinian refugees into a small, very area on the border. Where is Egypt in all of this? Is Israel, according to your impression, strategically consulting with Egypt about such an attack? Because it's going to be on the Egyptian border, and there will be impact on that area as well that will resonate in Egypt.
Egypt is, at least publicly, because you have a virulently anti-Jewish Egyptian populace is totally against it. Why the Egyptian government doesn't want Hamas have the civilians there who are radicalized, because they are the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood is the arch enemy of the Egyptian government.
Right.
The piece probably 6 weeks ago saying that Israel and Egypt should have come together. Egypt saying it will take half of the refugees, and Israel should have put the other half of its refugees in the Negev in a temporary tent city. To show the Biden administration was willing to take painful choices here, even after October 7th. I thought that would be the best situation to go through. But is Israel talking with Egypt? Absolutely. Does Egypt have preparations if the people start running through and overrunning Rafah? Yes, they do. But that is not the way to handle this, because you do not want to destabilize an Egyptian government of 100 million Egyptians. Imagine remember the Syrian civil war? Imagine a thousandfold worse if there's destabilization in Egypt and that very old peace breaks. So this is, I think Israel has not done the best job here, but it's not too late to make some decisions. And tomorrow, today, they should be dealing with the humanitarian situation and have a plan and start moving the civilians out of Rafah.
What do you think about the American administration's plan to establish the sea access for humanitarian aid to Gaza? Is it favorable towards Israel's position, or is it contradictory to Israel's position in the war? How do you see that move?
So I've spoken to COGAT, which is in charge of getting humanitarian aid in. The reason
the IDF, COGAT, just for the sake of our viewers. Israel.
You know, it's interesting. The IDF tells me technically they're not part of them, but that's for a different time.
Yeah, don't believe them. They're always trying to shake them off.
So I've met with them. I've met with them before. They're saying they could move 50 plus trucks an hour coming in.
Right.
And it's not just, they say the bottom line is as soon as the trucks go through, they are being looted by Hamas. But on the other side is that the human rights organizations that are saying that Israel is deliberately causing a siege and starving them have no infrastructure, and it's way beyond UNRWA to distribute the aid that's going in.
I think we've seen the kind of constructive role that UNRWA is playing in this conflict for years. But Eric, isn't that the question, really? Exactly what you just said about not getting the aid to cross the border into the Gaza Strip, but what's happening when it's there? Because if the population has no access to it, and we've seen Hamas people firing and killing, you know, ordinary Gazans to get hold of that aid, isn't that the issue at hand here? Rather than, because we know Israel has allowed over 16,000 trucks to come in the course of the last 5 months.
Right. There shouldn't be starvation if the people were getting access to it. And also Hamas, by the way, is reselling it up 1,000%.
Reselling it. Reselling it to Gazans. Wow.
Right. So they can, as part of money making, to continue their war machine. So I answered your question kind of backwards. You're asking about the port. It's not the port, because there is the aid that can go in. It comes in through Ashdod. It then goes through the Kerem Shalom crossing. It can go in through everything. There are ways to make this happen, or through Rafah, through Egypt itself, but it gets checked by Israel first. It can happen. The port may make it somehow easier, but what happens is they've won here on a diplomatic, or I should say a public relations front, making that Americans have to create this port because Israelis are starving us. And that really is not the truth. Israel is no interest for Israel to starve the civilian people that are there. So this is part of the really
election
horrific.
Year? Is it part of the election year trick by the Biden administration to appease anti-Israel voters within the Democratic Party?
Well, I think the president is making a mistake. President, by appeasing members of the far left of his party or anti-Israel, would make sense if he was running in a primary. He's running unopposed. The president needs to get into general election mode. The general election mode means that he needs to appeal to moderates and independents. By the president pandering to the far left, that undermines him with the people he needs to win in a general election. And so what the president should do, and by the way, it's good politics because still the majority of Americans sympathize with Israel and its plight, is to say to his far left base, hey, you know, I understand there's terrible problems there, but American and American security interests are going to stand with Israel. And that would be equivalent to if people of older viewers can remember what President Clinton did in 1992. It was called his sister soldier moment, where he attacked somebody on his far left, sister soldier, who basically said there should be a week where white people are killed. And it was so outrageous. He attacked his left and it positioned him in the center. So on a purely political level, the president should stand bed with Israel. Pandering to anti-Israel people of his far left will hurt him in being elected.
You know, Eric, you don't have only experience on the Hill. You're also, you know, a veteran speaker when it comes to U.S. college campuses. And I got to ask you from a commonsensical perspective. Here is the state of Israel, a liberal, modern democracy that is the spearhead of American interests and Western values in the region and across the world. And on the other hand, you have a savage, vile terrorist organization that massacred, raped, and abducted innocent people from their beds on a Saturday morning. And continuously, reports keep on coming out about the cruelty in the course of that day, and of course, towards the hostages, whether they were released or still there. How come this is even a struggle when it comes to the field of public opinion, when you have people on college campuses or on general, you know, global media outlets looking at this and, you know, drawing parallels between Israel and those people, or talking about supporting those people as opposed to supporting Israel? What is this gap from? What's the reason for this? Something that needs to be, you know, so easy on its face has become so difficult for so many people. Why is that, Eric?
So this didn't happen post October 7th. We're dealing with a few generations, 20, 25, 30 years that there has been Israel. Israel has become a victimizer. Israel's an oppressor. It's a colonialist. It has stolen other people's land. It's the only country in the world that that its right to exist is questioned. And on college campuses, this intersectionality that victims have to align with victims, and that is what is in. So if you are a minority on campus, you know, Black Lives Matter, Palestinian Lives Matter. But when you really think about it, the media and do not do us any favors, because they are, when they say these protests, they're pro-Palestinian, they're anti-Palestinian, they are pro-Hamas. That's what you pointed out, because if you really care about the Palestinian people, the rally should be about Hamas surrendering and let the Palestinian people have a future. Correct. So is really, you know, what the problem is. But we're dealing, and one of the big things, and there's so much, this is a whole other conversation, the divestment, equity, and inclusion departments that are in academic campuses and corporations, academia, right, have become the spear of anti-Semitism. Anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism are, according to International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition, true, they're one in the same.
You know, it brings to my mind a sticker I saw the other day on one of the Ivy League campuses that said, "Rape is resistance." Unbelievable. And these are supposedly people who believe in, you know, liberal principles and liberal ideologies and woke ideology, and then by any means necessary. It kind of boggles the mind and the heart.
Yes, it does. And unfortunately, there are, I'll say, somewhat, they call themselves Jewish groups, like Jewish Voice for Peace. Yeah. I'm Jewish, so I can't be anti-Semitic. Right. You know, fringe groups are given prominence as a cover for blatant. And as I say, my friend, Judea Pearl from California, whose son was killed, Daniel Pearl, says, "Eric, it's not anti-Semitism. This is Jew hatred."
Right.
And that's what we're really dealing with. October 7th seemed to give license to mainstream and say in public things that we never said before about hating Jews and attacking them. And what goes on campuses, getting rid of the college presidents, that's just the beginning. It is so much deeper. All of a sudden, free speech is now important. Before, but they were chasing, pro-Israel speakers off of campuses.
Right.
You know, they're defending people who defend Hamas, saying that's free speech. Before, microaggressions, a tiny little insult, perceived insult, you basically will be suspended. But now macroaggressions against Jewish students are tolerated. Right. It is deep. And basically, you know, if anybody are major funders to universities, don't threaten to withhold money to university. Stop it now.
Right.
then make say it will only come back if X, Y, and Z happen. Threatening doesn't work. It has to be actually stopped. And the government has to enforce Title VI to protect Jewish students like every other student in the country.
It's quite worrying to think about where we reached. And you're right to call out Professor Pearl. You know, he always repeats that Zionophobia has become such a terrible phenomenon. I gotta take you back for a minute to the geopolitics. And I feel that a lot of focus has been on the South and what's happening in Gaza. And again, the IDF has had tremendous success on the ground. I mean, to commend the soldiers and the officers fighting and taking out Hamas. We've just heard reports that possibly the number three in Hamas's leadership, who's been hiding in the tunnels, might have been taken out, Marwan Issa, which is great news, and hopefully it's correct. I want to take you back to the North. We've had a war going on up north, and you mentioned the tens of thousands of evacuees. And some people talk about escalation. Let's talk about that escalation. What does that escalation mean? In whose interest is it? Because it's sure not in the interest of ordinary Lebanese. And Iran's role in activating Hezbollah, because we all know Hezbollah is nothing but a proxy. How do you see the Northern Front in this regard?
So you hit the nail on the head. People keep saying, does Hezbollah want to get involved? The answer from on tactical level, they can be firing rockets and totally in control. But on the big level, this is not Hezbollah's decision. This is Iran's decision. And this is really the problem with American policy. Everything goes back to Iran. And if Iran does not pay a consequence for what Hezbollah does, what Hamas does, the Houthis do, what they do to our soldiers and popular mobilization units against our soldiers in Iraq and Syria, Iran will be more than happy to die, fight to the last drop of Arab blood. Remember that Hezbollah, which follows exactly their footsteps, they are Shiites, but they're Arabs. There's a big difference here. So unless Iran pays a price, then you're not going to be able to deal with anything here. Getting to the war, I'm actually much more concerned about the North than I am about the South. The picture of the South going in the future is going to be what is in the West Bank. Israel is going to be able to leave Gaza Strip and then go in and extract terrorists when needed. But in the North, the day after is so much harder. Why? Because Israel has nobody to give southern Lebanon to, if say Israel does fulfill UN Security Council Resolution 1701 by force, gets Hezbollah out. The Lebanese armed forces are either complicit or impotent. They can't do anything. No Arab country really wants to go into the quagmire of Lebanon. So that means Israel might have to reoccupy southern Lebanon. So the day after for the North is much worse. Of course, you know that the missile arsenal will overwhelm the multi-layered anti-Israel missile system of Iron Dome, David Sling, Arrow, Patriot, and they can and hit every place in Israel. But another thing to realize, as devastating as Hezbollah's is, Iran itself has much more than Hezbollah and could join in the fight from there, besides its proxies shooting from Yemen or Syria or Iraq. So that northern war, was going to be very difficult, and it's going to take a much bigger toll than on the south. But Israel, I have to say, Hezbollah is not willing to go back 20 miles north across the Litani River, move its Radwan forces. Those are the attack forces equivalent to the Nukba forces of Hamas, but much, much more dangerous. That would take over communities in the north. And the current plan, and this is what I wrote a piece on in The Hill this week, is that the Israel Defense Forces is worried that a political deal will only move them maybe 10 kilometers north, and that's indefensible for the north. And what kind of country, if it can't protect its citizens to live right up to its border, is it really, especially a small country? So Israel has very big problems going forward. But if you don't address Iran, this will all keep happening again and again and again. It will be Israel's Groundhog Day.
To address Iran, Israel could either, think about doing it militarily or might require a grander understanding by Western powers that they need to stand by Israel in curbing the Iranian influence in the region, which in all true and effect can really help push the region into more stability and you know, rather peace, because we've seen the Iranian influence in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, in Lebanon, in the Palestinian areas. We know what they're trying to do in destabilizing the region. I want to ask you, Eric, have you seen such willingness on the side of the U.S. and other Western allies to come not to Beirut, but to Tehran, demanding them to take a step back or else, which may be the only way to curb Hezbollah and prevent an all-out war? Have you seen such willingness?
Rhetoric, no actions. Just think about it. We, the United States, are not enforcing the sanctions, the oil sanctions that are in place. Iran is selling an unlimited amount of oil to India and China. When Iran attacked our soldiers, we attacked their proxies. We did not attack anything in Iran. People say, well, that would cause an escalation in a regional war. That's not how this region thinks. If Iran feels threatened and they want to survive, you have to make them pay a consequence. They have many vulnerable places that we could even symbolically send in some missiles just to let them know we can stop them. We are handling this incredibly poorly. There's no willingness because they think this will put us into another quagmire of a regional war, just like we tried with Afghanistan and Iraq. But, you know, it's funny. I was interviewed in 2003 on ABC. It's right before American troops went into Iraq. And they said to me, should we go in? And I'll never forget my answer. I said, if you don't have an answer for Iran, don't bother going into Iraq.
Oh, wow.
It's this...
Quite the foresight.
Yeah. I mean, and really, it should have been really clear and obvious what it was at that time. It was prescient, but it wasn't that much analysis to have come to a simple conclusion. Iran is the problem. America should say, we want to be pro-Iranian. What does pro-Iranian mean? Being for the Iranian people. We want them to take control of their lives and have regime change.
Right.
Hate us anymore if we say that. And most regime change in the world is non-kinetic, is non-military. But we want to give them the support to say, we want you to have the best of your lives. And that's how you change the Middle East. But we have had feckless leadership on Iran for multiple administrations.
And the truth is that I'm seeing parallels here, Eric, between the way Hamas is viewed, you know, understanding that there is a separation, a contradiction of interest between the savage military terrorist organization Hamas and people in Gaza, and the people of Iran and the mullah's regime that also has been, that regime itself has been experiencing inner turmoil. So I want to take you one step further, Eric, and just tap into that expertise of yours and foresight. We're talking about Iran now. What happens, and we all know Iran is racing to the bomb, what happens after they get their hands on a nuclear bomb when it comes to the ability to threaten the mullah regime?
So first of all, the IAEA, which monitors this, come out recently with a
International
very negative
Atomic Energy Committee, right?
Yes. And they basically wanted to come out, and the Europeans were for it to really condemn Iran, you know, that there's no inspectors and cameras and the amount of enriched uranium, right, and all these other things. And the report is the United States didn't want that because they didn't want to antagonize Iran. They don't understand that is literally saying that you are weak, that you're not willing to stand up for what's there. I just want to get one point. If the Iranian regime changed, the Iranian people, I think, would be very supportive of the West. Problem with the Palestinian people, even after Hamas, is the brainwashing and the believing that all the land is still theirs. When I go and talk to Palestinians, they basically believe the Jews stole their land. And this is even people who are citizens of Israel who do very well. They just don't think Israel has a true right to exist, even if they do well within that. So I actually am more optimistic of regime change a day after of the Iranian people than I am of the Palestinian people, whether in the West Bank or Gaza.
Right. If there is one lesson that we've learned from October 7th, and I think that Israelis really understood that point, is believe them when they tell you who they are. And if you take that principle and apply it to the mullah regime, it's a real cause for concern.
It is. The thing, I remember my time I met with Hamas in the West Bank with a leader there, and he told us exactly what they wanted to do. I appreciated the honesty. Tehran, remember, these are revolutionary radical Islamists. They do want to survive, but they don't think about, I just want best economic interests for my people.
Right.
They are ideologues, and they're willing to sacrifice their people. And there's cultures of death, unfortunately, as part of these regimes. They don't project our Western ways on these people. What the Iranians say and want is just what the Hamas charter says. Remember, one is Sunni Arab, the one is Shiite Persian. It's two sides of the same coin. They are all about destroying Israel and killing Jews, and that is not an exaggeration.
And that's even when we say Israel and Jews, they're actually talking about, infidels in general, not just, I mean, Israel might be the first step in this journey, but their overarching goal, and we've heard Hamas leaders announce already in 2008 their desire to Islamize America or to conquer the West and bring it down in the name of these values. And it's, understanding that threat, I think, is the first step and key to be able to tackle it. And I want to ask you about an important point. We look at this war as Israel versus Hamas, but it really is at the foundation of the Western and US interests in the region. Like an Israeli victory is an American interest, is it not, Eric?
Yes. So I'm an American who speaks to the Senate primarily for American national security interests, which to my mind at this point of time are coincident with Israel's 95% of the time. And America, the world is a much better place when America is not isolationist, but acts in the world. And that decreases the chance for wars. When America withdraws, that's when you invite into that vacuum some of the worst players, and some of those worst players are radical Islamists of both Shiite and Sunni variety. So one of the keys right now is, will America be able to open up the Red Sea in the chokeholds called Bab el-Mandeb
Right.
from the Houthis? We just had a ship attack. We have to keep freedom of navigation going. We need to show that we stand with our allies. One of the things that happened in both, I'll give you two things that the region started losing trust in us. When President Biden withdrew from Afghanistan, that message reverberated all the way to Taipei, showing that we don't stand with allies. And
Wow.
also, I will say to President Trump, when he didn't respond to the Iranian attack on the Saudi oil facilities in 2019, that also showed that America may not be as reliable an ally. But America, all these countries know that America's number one ally in the region, maybe in the world, is Israel. And if America starts slow walking munitions, that undermines American security interests, because we the Americans, become looking unreliable in the eyes of nations that haven't decided to go towards China or go to us.
Right. And it's one of the most important points that we need to make today, Eric, because people try to isolate the area, the issue, as an Israeli-Hamas issue. And the truth is that this has severe and profound regional and global ramifications.
Absolutely. What goes on right now is the whole world is watching. It's this
The
little
whole
tiny,
world is watching.
the whole world, the Russians are watching, the Iranians, the Chinese, what they call the axis of resistance, the people in countries in Africa, the Far East, where America wants to pivot to. Everybody is looking to see how strong America will stand with its ally, and will it stand up for its interests? Because one day they're going to come for me. Israel is as the old expression, the canary in the coal mine.
Right.
And Israel dies, they know that they're next.
If we learned, something from our history, we know that what starts with the Jews never ends with the Jews, and what starts with the Jewish state doesn't end there. I remember the suicide bombings perpetrated in Israel back in the mid-90s after the signing of the Oslo Accords, again by the same vile, barbaric organization, Hamas. And a few years later, these very attacks appeared on the global stage in various cities. So if we needed an example or a short history lesson, there it is for us. So what's your take at this point in time, Eric, on US-Israel relations as we, are in the fifth month of the war and moving forward? How do you see those relations at the moment?
Troubled waters. Because the Netanyahu government is in political mode and basically speaking to a domestic audience. I heard this directly from the highest levels in the government, that that's where they're prioritizing. And that directly goes against smoothing out relations. The idea that that the Prime Minister Netanyahu took on the hard right, Ben-Gvir and Smoltrich, he has done him no favors, and that is, he gets no benefit of the doubt. And that is basically for whether you're talking about occupation, settlements, two states, Rafah, the North. All of that has made Israel's situation in helping its relations with the United States, which it needs, made it much, much more difficult. It is up, and this is what I tried last week in speaking to the Knesset, to the International Affairs Committee people, to diplomats, to the foreign ministry, to Bibi's number one advisor, to say you have to change the way you respond. You're in the middle of a war. After the war, you can have these fights, but right now you need to find a way to work together with your only friend. And if munitions start going slow, and Israel cannot fulfill what it needs to do in Rafah, because America is leveraging that power it has, that will be terrible going forward. This is an incredibly a fragile moment in the relations. But I have to say, it's up to Israel to take the initiative here and reshape it as best as it can.
And from your impression, meeting with those people very close to the decision makers in Israel, doesn't Prime Minister Netanyahu and his cabinet ministers understand those facts? I mean, the Prime Minister has vast experience dealing with the world and specifically with the U.S. What is he missing, Eric?
Okay, so Bibi is brilliant. Bibi is an American-style politician, and Bibi wants to survive. Bibi, at the end of this, somehow believes, even though he was the captain of the ship for October 7th, and usually the captain should go down with the ship, that he somehow, as a cat with nine lives, has to come out as a winner. And he believes he can, and he is prioritizing that. And to my mind, and this is not about anti-Bibi, but I do believe that a true leader, and Bibi always idolized Winston Churchill. I think Bibi has to look at what Churchill did, and he has to say, not my personal interest. He has to say, what is best for my country? He was always a patriot. He still is a patriot, but he's right now an inflection point. He has to make a decision, what is best for my country. And right now, hurting U.S.-Israel relations is a top priority. It's as important as kinetic warfare. And I think he's underestimating that, or his ability as a magician to get out of it. He can't. It is getting worse. He really needs to change at this point of time. And that's what I tried to emphasize to them last week.
You know, one of the main things that Prime Minister Netanyahu has been doing vis-a-vis the Israeli public is talking about the issue that President Biden just referred to as the two-state solution. And what Netanyahu is telling Israelis is, I'm the only Israeli leader who can withstand international pressure and can say no to the establishment of a Palestinian state. Now, the truth is that the mere mentioning of a two-state solution or a Palestinian state post-October 7th is, not to say abomination, but at least an anomaly in the, you know, in the ears of so many Israelis who are unwilling to even go in this direction, as in not giving a reward to terrorists. How do you see, what was your impression about that talk about the two-state solution as it reverberated through Israel?
So I think people thought it was ludicrous, perverse, obscene. I mean, it just in at this point of time to bring it up. Having said that, it has been brought up. It's how you handle it. I don't, you know, I have no problem with a vote of not, you know, of the 99 votes out of 120.
So that's the Knesset voting against international pressure forcing the establishment of a Palestinian state.
So that was basically a unilateral declaration.
Right. But which is rather rare in the Israeli Knesset. But it's also right. Very much reflective of where Israelis are, not just Netanyahu.
Right. There were some people who would have also voted for, but even out of politics, chose not to vote for it. It's how you handle it. What you do is you turn it on its head. You say, yes, it is an Israeli interest for there to be Palestinian independence or a path to that. It doesn't talk about a state, but it talks about self-sufficiency. So you say, however, the first thing that has to happen is they have to create rule of law.
Right.
They have to stop paying for terrorists, the pay for slave program.
Right.
They have to have freedom of press. They have to protect minority rights. People, you know, you have these things where it says queers for Palestine, and they have no idea that if you were gay in the territories, you could be in feces up to your neck or dead. The only happy gay people in the region are in Tel Aviv.
Right. Or those Palestinians who escaped from Palestinian autonomous rule into Israel.
Exactly. So, you know, the point here is to create the circumstances that the Palestinians have to say no, 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 no. And then all of a sudden, you're not talking about the two-state solution. Bibi is more than sophisticated enough to have turned this around. He chose not to for domestic political issues. It's don't get into a match, a fighting match with the president of the United States now over something like this where you can deflect it.
Right.
There are many ways, whether it's humanitarian aid, that you can deal with it. And that's what you need to do. You need to buy time to do what you need to do in the South and then maybe in the North.
So, Eric, not deflecting it the way you propose kind of sounds like it's a play in Israeli internal politics, kind of more than the prime minister and his people are speaking to the international community, they're speaking to their own public at home.
That's correct. So this, again, this is their in political season. You know, you just had Benny Gantz go against these wishes and go to the United States, the UK. Bibi, you know, really could have, if he wasn't in domestic mode, he could have used that to his advantage. Because the truth is, Benny Gantz and he are on the same page about
they are.
Rafah. And so it's not like you had somebody from the far left who said, you know, we should walk out or whatever it is.
Correct.
But pointing out that he was, disobedient of what it was, that was a political consideration. It was a mistake. Hurt Israel in a war effort, in my opinion, and it showed disunity to the United States. And so United States, UK, they pandered to Gantz because they thought that he's going to be more compliant. He's just doesn't have Ben-Gavir and Smoltz as an anchor.
Right. And, it's election mode in the U.S., election mode in Israel, and it doesn't seem to do us any good. Time is almost out, Eric. So I'll ask you a quick question, which I think is quite evident from everything else that we've spoken about. How do you see the future vis-a-vis a potential deal with Saudi Arabia in light of everything that you've already mentioned?
So I happen to have, without mentioning specifics, but I've spoken to my Saudi friends recently. They are as nice as ever.
You also visited Saudi Arabia not too long ago.
Yeah, I was supposed to actually be back there a short time ago, but with the war, I didn't think it was necessarily the best time to go. You don't feel the anti-Semitism you feel in Egypt or Jordan. I'm optimistic that Mohammed bin Salman wants to bring Israel in for his Vision 2030. I think if once he goes in, countries like the most populous Muslim country in the world, Indonesia, might join in. There's all kinds of possibilities because they like what Israel could offer them economically. But the Palestinians are again being allowed to have a veto on advancing their interests. So down the road, I don't know where down the road it is, but down the road, I think that it will be there. The real question, though, is if Israel doesn't pair victorious at the end of this, the Saudis are not going to be so interested in being close with Israel. Israel needs to come out as the strong power in the Middle East, and that's a reason for the Saudis to want to normalize them beyond the economics.
Eric, I don't see any other option for Israel and Israelis, and definitely not in Israelis' mind, than to, as we say, finish the job, don't you think?
Israel has to finish the job in Gaza, do what it needs to do in the north, do what it needs to do in Judea and Samaria, be strong, be perceived as strong, and only in this region, if you're perceived strong, then you have leverage to negotiate diplomatically, and what the Saudis will respect and the rest of the Arab world will respect.
Eric, what a joy it is always to speak to you and tap into that incredible ocean, not even a sea, of knowledge that you have. And for the sake of our viewers, for anyone who wants to follow your analysis and read, the impressions of your visits and all of these pearls of wisdom that you've been able to provide us, please give some details to our viewers. How can they follow you?
So please follow me on Instagram. It's Dr. Eric Mandel, Dr. Eric Mandel. Please, if you can go to Mepin Analysis, MEPINANALYSIS.org, and you can write to me. I will respond to you. ermandelmd@gmail.com. So please follow me on Instagram and please go to Mepin Analysis and please reach out to me. I will respond because I really believe the one thing that we need is facts, facts in context, and really getting out the truth, not propaganda.
And also following your op-eds as you publish them from time to time in different outlets. And I'll also mention again your frequent appearances on college campuses.
Right. So please, as I say, not just follow me on Instagram and mepinanalysis.org, but I write for The Hill, I write for the Jerusalem Post, I'm the senior security editor for the Jerusalem Report. Please follow me. And again, my analysis does best when I hear people giving me their feedback. So please, I really want that.
I sure
And
do enjoy reading your pearls of wisdom and your smart analysis. It gives me a spectacular perspective, just like you're able to brief the high-level elected officials. And like you say, Eric, nothing better than facts and truth to fight the sea of misinformation and disinformation out there. Thank you so much for joining us and for your time.
having Thank you.
As always, what a stimulating conversation with Dr. Eric Mandel. Eric, you've definitely given us so much to think about. I'd like to thank you for all that you do, and we'll keep our eyes and ears open for your timely updates and wise analysis. And to you, our viewers, we will continue to keep you updated as things move forward in Israel. And it's always important to remind and remember, just like Eric said, it's not just about Israel and Hamas. These battles that take place in the Middle East today have great moral, strategic meanings for Israel, the United States, and indeed for the free world and the world entire. May we see better times soon. I'm Shachar Azani, and thank you all for watching.